Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the EU Emergency Summit to prevent further deaths of migrants, 1,750 of whom have drowned in the Mediterranean so far this year, prompting European leaders to promise more naval assets, but not much help for those 35,000 who have made it to Europe, and no strategy to stem the flow of refugees from Africa and the Middle East. Patrick Kingsley, the Egypt correspondent for the UK Guardian, who has investigated networks of human traffickers in Egypt and Libya, joins us from the island of Malta, where funerals for 24 of the 800 victims who lost their lives in last weekend's sinking were held today, with many buried in nameless graves. Then, as Saudi airstrikes resume in Yemen after a brief pause, we will look into what possible strategy the Saudis might have as they insist the rebel Houthis must give up all the territories they have captured before any talks begin, while at the same time the Houthis insist they won't begin talks unless Saudi airstrikes end. Shamin Nawani, a political analyst and commentator on Mideast politics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College, Oxford University, joins us from Beirut to discuss the growing problems the Saudis have around their periphery and at home with the restive Shia minority and 25% of the population living in poverty, while a billionaire prince offers 100 free Bentleys to 100 Saudi pilots who are bombing one of the poorest countries in the world. And joining us now from Malta is Patrick Kingsley, the Guardian's Egypt correspondent. He is the winner of the Frontline Award for Print Journalism, a finalist at the Foreign Press Awards, and was named Best Young Journalist at the 2014 British Press Awards. He's the author of How to Be Danish. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Kingsley.
Thanks for having me.
And you're in Malta, where there have been funerals of a number of the unfortunate victims of human trafficking going on in the Mediterranean. And there's been some very poignant pictures coming out of Malta with coffins unmarked of these nameless people who are being buried in something like a mass grave. Is that a correct description?
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I've only just arrived in Malta. I've come from Libya, where these people set sail from a few days ago. So I can tell you about the situation there. And I've been talking to smugglers and refugees and what you might call economic migrants who have arrived there in recent months, days and weeks in the hope of making their way across the seas. And I guess that the first thing that has struck me from all the interviews I've been doing is that most of these people that are going on these ships, yes, they're being mistreated sometimes by the smugglers, but they know what they're getting themselves in for. They know that there have been deaths. One Ghanaian I interviewed says, you know, of course we share around all these news stories about, you know, the latest disasters in the Mediterranean. But we also go in the knowledge of that, and we want to do this because our lives here in Libya, where there's a civil war and where illegal immigrants get exploited at every turn, be it by people, smugglers, or local businessmen who employ them and sometimes don't pay them, they feel that going to sea is you know, not a particularly bad option when contrasted with the other options available to them. They're in a country that has civil war, as I say. They're often coming from countries where there's severe repression or you know, another kind of civil war. For example, Syria. Syrians were the biggest group of migrants crossing the Mediterranean last year, and Eritreans were the second biggest group. So that tells you a certain story. It tells you that the majority of people crossing are people that are fleeing real hardship and are hoping for something better, and they're not getting it in the transit countries that they're moving to in the Middle East and North Africa, be that Libya, be it Egypt, where I'm usually based, or in Lebanon, Jordan. They're finding that, you know, the economic opportunities available to them, employment, jobs, education, they really don't really exist in somewhere like Cairo, where I live. And so a friend of mine, a Syrian who left Cairo and went to Alexandria on the Mediterranean coast and set sail about 10 days ago. He's just arrived in Italy. And, you know, he would say to me constantly, you know, I was a civil servant in Syria And here I'm no one. I'm working in a charcoal factory. I get picked up on the streets by the secret police. I get abused by people just for being Syrian. Here, people accuse us of being ISIS members when, of course, we're nothing of the sort. There's no life for us. It's very hard for Syrians to get residency in somewhere like Egypt, and of course, it's doubly hard in somewhere like Libya, where I've just come from. So basically, for there is perception that all these people who are dying in the seas are sort of almost being forced into going on the boats by people traffickers. But it's not quite as simple as that. These are people that really feel they have no choice but to go to sea because they haven't been offered any legal alternatives by places like the countries of the European Union.
So, Patrick Kingsley, in contrast, though, to the desperation and difficulties that these migrants, particularly from Syria, face, in a recent article that you wrote, you profiled Abu Hamada, a 62-year-old civil engineer from Damascus,
right,
who's in Cairo and earning £1.5 million in the last 6 months. And he seems to be almost proud of the fact that he's a people smuggler. And of course, at the EU conference that's taking place now, there's a lot of breastfeeding about we've got to go after the traffickers. This fellow seems to be fairly accessible from what you've written about him.
Well, accessible in what sense? It's quite hard as a journalist to get after him. I got to him after sort of months of calling him, and I don't know anyone else who's interviewed him. But certainly he believes he's providing a service to his fellow countrymen. He doesn't see what he's doing as exploitative. And you hear that time and again when you talk to these smugglers that, they hide behind the rhetoric of, our clients are people that really need to get to where they're going, and we're trying to facilitate that for them. Obviously, there's an enormous amount of self-benefit there. As you said, this chap's made $1.5 million in the last year. That piece was published in January. And another smuggler that I met in Libya just now says he makes $100,000 a year. I think that estimate's probably a bit low if you actually look at the breakdown per trip of what he says he makes. So, there's enormous amounts of money being made. But there's another thing I think that should be emphasized here. As you say, in Europe, there's a lot of breastbeating about how we've got to go after the smugglers. But the question is, how exactly would you do that? Because these networks, they're not always the most precise organizations, and that's one of the points I tried to get across in that piece you mentioned. You can articulate a certain method through which people get to the sea and then get on boats and then arrive in Europe, but the process breaks down when you try and compare one migrant's experience to another. They all have different ways of doing it. They're all dealing with different brokers. Those brokers have changing relationships with different boat owners that morph on a kind of week by week basis. So these are informal networks that it's quite hard to pin down exactly who runs what. And my conclusion is no one actually oversees the whole process. So you might take out a big link in a certain chain, but others can fill that place. And when I was in Libya just now, I was sitting in the fishing port of Zuwara, watching fishing boats move out to sea one evening, and a smuggler that given me into, he said, that boat is going to go and take some refugees to Italy now, and that surprised me because it was just an ordinary fishing boat, and lo and behold, he said this fishing boat that was now a smuggling boat had in fact been an ordinary fishing boat, as I suspected, in recent days, and it was only because the smuggler had recently bought it off a local fisherman that it was suddenly turned into a smuggling boat. And I think what that tells us is that, if you want to target smugglers' boats, that's kind of a bit of a non-starter, because their boats are just normal fishing trawlers that are turned, at the last minute into modes of transport for people trying to cross the Mediterranean. And it shows you how the smuggling economy is closely entwined with more legal forms of making money, such as fishing or shipping along the North African coast. And so I think we have to think very clearly very carefully, rather, when we talk about, you know, going after the smugglers, about what exactly that might involve and whether it's actually possible to do, except in terms of just bombing whole fishing ports. I think a much more realistic strategy is to create economic alternatives in these places so that people don't just turn to organized crime, or rather not particularly organized crime, as I've tried to suggest. And to do that, you need to end the civil war in Libya, and you need to end wars in the countries of origin as well. So you really need long-term plans rather than just short-term eye-catching phrases that the politicians make when they talk about going after particular human traffickers.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Kingsley, The Guardian's Egypt correspondent. He's the winner of the Frontline Award for Print Journalism, a finalist at the Foreign Press Awards, and was named Best Young Journalist at the 2014 British Press Awards. He's the author of How to Be Danish, and he joins us from Malta. Well, of course, the head of the EU Border Agency has said that saving migrants' lives in the Mediterranean should not be the priority of the maritime patrols that he's in charge of. And in going after the smugglers, which is a lot of the rhetoric coming out of the EU crisis meeting, it's pretty clear from your reporting, Patrick Kingsley, that the smugglers have some kind of relationship via middlemen with the Egyptian authorities, for example. Obviously, in a failed state like Libya, it's a lot easier. But it would seem to me that the Egyptian authorities, I'm sure, are telling the EU that they're doing the best they can. But money talks, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, we don't know how far the corruption goes, but certainly, as I said in that piece, and as Libyan smugglers told me this week, Coast Guards, policemen on a lower level are getting paid off to allow busloads of refugees to arrive at beachheads and to allow fishing boats to leave fishing ports and never come back. So, as you say, that shows that there is a certain level of complicity among officials in both countries that allows this to happen. So, you know, once again, it's not a question of just arresting a few smugglers and that will be that. It goes beyond that. It goes to the local communities where this kind of activity has approval from certain quarters who benefit from the economic boost that this kind of business gives. And it goes into, you know, local coast guards and at times local police forces. You know, if you have very low-paid policemen and very low-paid coast guards, or in the case of Libya where you have people who haven't got paid for months and months and months, you're not really giving them incentive to crack down on this kind of activity hard.
And what do you think explains the callousness? For example, why are the Egyptians so almost contemptuous of the Syrians who, through no fault of their own, largely because of the family dictatorship's boneheaded insistence that they have a right to rule that country indefinitely, which has led to a civil war?
Well, there's two things to say here. First of all, I mean, there are many Egyptians who, of course, are very generous to anyone, including myself, as a guest in their country. But the second thing is that, yes, there are a lot of instances, particularly from 2013 to 14, where television presenters would talk about Syrians in the most inflammatory of terms. And there was one where one TV presenter said that Syrians should be hit with shoes, which is a gross insult. And the reason is probably that twofold. One is that inevitably in a country where resources are already stretched, it's only natural that people would start to get resentful of outsiders. It's lamentable, but it happens the world over. It happens in the United Kingdom, it happens in Europe, and it happens in the US. But the second thing is a more specific thing, which is that Syrians, for one reason or another, were collectively associated with the former president, Mohamed Morsi. And he was very welcoming to Syrians. They were given almost untrammeled access to state resources during his presidency. And then when he was ousted, the new regime very quickly reversed some of the concessions and benefits that he'd given to Syrian refugees, and they made it very hard for Syrians to enter Egypt, and they made it very hard for them to stay without proper paperwork, which was a reverse on what the status was before. And because of that, then the tide turned and public opinion turned very quickly. And so Egypt went from being one of the best places for Syrians to be to being one of the worst spaces. And there were countless instances where Syrians would get stopped in the street, and because they hadn't felt the need to get proper paperwork under Morsi, they were hamstrung because the situation turned overnight and suddenly they were expected to have all the right paperwork and residency papers and UN asylum cards and so on and so forth. And, you know, a lot of people spent time in police cells afterwards. So that, you know, that's an overview of the situation. One is the natural thing that happens the world over when local people get resentful of foreigners supposedly stealing all their resources. And the second thing is a more Egypt-specific political situation.
So obviously the idea that which is being discussed at the EU summit, that we should deal with the conditions in the countries from which these people are fleeing, and all the way down through Africa, starting in Nigeria is where a lot of the people are coming from Eritrea, etc. That, of course, is a lofty but perhaps not particularly practical goal. There have been more than 35,000 who've crossed from Africa to Europe this year, and about 1,750 have died while attempting the journey. The impression I get is that the European leaders, they don't want to have to appear indifferent to the fact that these migrants are drowning in the Mediterranean, and the Pope talking about the Mediterranean being a vast cemetery. But they don't also, many of the countries don't want these immigrants to begin with. So how do you think they're going to navigate this, what appears to be a public relations nightmare?
Well, they seem to be doing it quite badly, in my view. You know, the obvious act of moral leadership, surely after the week that we've had, would have been to immediately reinstall Operation Mare Nostrum, which was this full-scale search and rescue operation that the Italians ran last year, but they stopped doing it because the rest of the EU wouldn't help them, and it was a very costly procedure. And I think they were trying to encourage other European countries to get their act together. They didn't, and so since last October, we've had a very scaled-back naval operation dealing with this wave of migration. And it's not even a search and rescue operation. It's basically border surveillance. So it's not the same thing at all. So what we've seen is almost shocking, in my view. You know, we've got thousands of people going across the sea, thousands dying, and there hasn't been a courageous act of moral leadership on the part of European politicians to really try and do the only thing that in the short term that would stop this from happening, and that's getting a proper search and rescue operation back underway. The reasons for this, I think, are because in Europe there's probably an almost unprecedented rise in my lifetime of the far right and anti-immigrant views. And, you know, now is not the time to be seen to be allowing more and more immigrants into fortress Europe. And the victims of that policy are the people who have died in the sea, I think.
Well, the UK, though, who certainly did pressure Italy to abandon Mare Nostrum and to come up with this less robust program called Triton, the UK appears to have reversed itself. At least they pledged a helicopter carrier, HMS Bulwark, two patrol boats and three helicopters. Would that have something to do with the elections underway? Is Cameron getting heat from Nigel Lafarge, and on the one hand, but on the other hand, you know, the humanitarian outcry must be also resonating.
I have to be honest, I've got off a plane and I've been in transit most of the afternoon, so I haven't properly got to grips with what exactly Cameron's done. But yes, he's in a tight spot because he has the UK Independence Party, UKIP, Nigel Farage being the leader of that party. He's got them breathing down his neck. He needs to be able to win over people thinking of voting for UKIP if he's going to win this upcoming election. And UKIP are not a party that really wants to see more immigrants come to the UK at all. So, you know, that's one factor in Cameron's decision-making. On the other hand, you know, he's seeing thousands of people dying in the Mediterranean, and the natural reaction would be to try and help them. Are patrol helicopters the right answer? I'm not sure. You know, we need boats that are in position And it can get to places of disaster, places of maritime disaster, within a very short space of time. And it's all very well to have planes patrolling and helicopters patrolling, but if you can't get the boat, rescue boats, to the places of disaster soon enough, well, then you're still going to have the same problems that we've had in the past few weeks and months, which has been an unprecedented rise in the number of deaths in the Mediterranean. So if that's what's happened, if he has pledged more assets, that's fantastic, but it needs to be the right kind of assets, and it needs to arrive. My interview with the head of the EU Borders Agency yesterday revealed that not all the assets, not all the boats and planes that have been pledged, even for this very scaled-back maritime operation that the EU has been running in the last 6 months, not even all of those have actually arrived in the EU border agency's pockets. And if that's the case, then we need to kind of be sure that all of these new things that are being pledged are actually going to happen, and the proof will be in the pudding.
Well, just in closing, Patrick Kingsley, if they could get more patrol boats in there and prevent these rickety crafts, these unseaworthy vessels from sinking, one would think, though, that as you rescue people, you would either confiscate the boat or let it sink. Is there an inexhaustible supply of, you mentioned the fishing boat that turned into a smuggling boat while you were there in Libya. Is there an inexhaustible supply of boats, or could you just simply start confiscating them and that would make a difference?
Well, you could start confiscating them, but who's going to do that? Is it the Libyan law enforcement?
Right.
Is it, and if so, which government are we talking about? The situation in Libya is such that you have countless militias who are all vying for control of that country, and they're not really in a position, and they haven't really got the resources to start this kind of confiscation. So one option that does exist, and is even articulated to me by a leading smuggler in Libya, is that when these boats take refugees towards Italy, and the passengers of that boat are then at some point hopefully rescued by Italian coast guards or Maltese coast guards, at that point, the boats that they were on, the smuggling boats they were on, need to be destroyed. If they're not destroyed, what happens is the smugglers come out from Libya, they know perfectly well where the boats tend to end up, and they tow these empty vessels back to Libya, and then they reuse them. And there's one instance, the smuggler said, where he's used the same boat four times. And his point is that if you want to put pressure on the resources available to the smugglers, you've got to start sinking those boats after you've rescued the passengers, otherwise they'll get reused. The flip side of that is if you think it through, it means there'll be a drought of boats, and the few boats that are left will be crammed with even more migrants, which means there's going to be a greater risk of maritime disaster. And so, quite obviously, the first idea I mentioned needs to be balanced with the latter. But it's perhaps in these more specific, practical ideas that the EU politicians need to be thinking about, rather than just talking in sort of general terms about cracking down on trafficking networks that they probably don't actually realise how they work.
Well, Patrick Kingsley, I thank you so much for joining us here.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Kingsley, who is in Malta. He is The Guardian's Egypt correspondent and the winner of the Frontline Award for Print Journalism, a finalist at the Foreign Press Awards, and was named Best Young Journalist at the 2014 British Press Awards. He's the author of How to Be Danish. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what possible strategies the Saudis might have as they resume their bombing of Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is Sharmeen Nawani, who's a political analyst and commentator on Mideast geopolitics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College, Oxford University. She blogs at MideastShuffle.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sharmeen Nawani.
Thank you, Ian.
And the Saudis just only a few days ago announced a halt to their bombing, and now they've resumed their bombing. And my understanding is that there's a sort of a standoff in Yemen where the Hadi in exile in Saudi Arabia said that they'll only talk if the Houthis quit cities that they've occupied, particularly the port of Aden, and lay down their arms. That seems like a non-starter. And then the Houthis on the other hand, they say that they'll only talk if the airstrikes stop completely. So is there any indication or any sense that this standoff will end?
It's really hard to say. I think what's going on in Yemen is very confusing to a lot of people, even, I think, Yemen experts. I think we have to look at the rationale behind why the situation is going on. And, you know, whether or not it is rational behavior that we've been observing for the past few weeks from the Saudis and their coalition partners, you know, they've named some of their objectives in this campaign. And when they announced the stopping of their halting of their bombing a few days ago, said they had achieved victory and reached their goals. But clearly, none of these things have happened. So what are the Saudis' goals in the bombing? If in fact, it has been to, you know, reinstate Hadi, they have not reached that objective. If it's to sort of hinder Iran's influence, well, they haven't made any inroads there. If it's to control the situation in Yemen and assert its position as the regional hegemon in the Persian Gulf, well, they're very far from that. So, you know, any kind of ceasefire will depend on both parties having, or at least one party having obtained its objectives and the other party conceding defeat, or things getting so out of hand that both realize that they have to come to the negotiating table. I don't think either of those are clear. So I think that's why we're all rather confused about the various sound bites we've been hearing the last few days from Yemen and around Yemen.
Well, for the longest time, the Saudis have been quite cautious in their foreign policy, and a lot of analysts are quite surprised at this sudden assertiveness. There's some speculation that it may have something to do with the inexperience of the king's young son, who is now the new defense minister and who seems to be running the show. He's unlike most of the princes. He wasn't educated abroad, was educated in Saudi Arabia. There's speculation that this may be somewhat seat-of-the-pants, petulant behavior. And there's no question, though, is there, that the Saudis are pretty frustrated with the Americans?
I don't think there has been a lot of conjecture about whether this operation can be blamed on the inexperience of the young defense minister. If you look back at the last few years since the beginning of the Arab Spring and the entrance of Saudi Arabia as a counter-revolutionary force in the Arab Spring, you see that the same kind of erratic behavior that seems to lack focus and objective from the Saudis throughout for the last 4 years. So I'm not sure that this is any different than what we've been seeing from Saudi Arabia, as their perhaps irrational fears have escalated. Now, the Saudis are hyper-focused on their adversary, their main adversary in the region, Iran. And everything, all policies, all actions seem to emanate from this. They look at what's going on in their direct neighborhood and throughout the larger Middle East through the prism of whether or not any action on that day will increase Iranian influence in the region and therefore decrease Saudi influence. So they've been taking, rather than having a concrete strategy, they seem to have taken the strategy of throwing the kitchen sink at any problem that comes their way. And we've seen this in Syria, we've seen this in Iraq, we've seen it in Bahrain, we've seen it in Egypt, and now in Yemen. So I don't know that their strategy towards Yemen is very much different from their strategy towards other neighboring countries in the last 4 years.
Well, there's no question that their strategy of counter-revolution to blunt the Arab Spring has worked, but of course it has had the blowback of creating the Islamic State, or helped to create the Islamic State. So do you expect that there be blowback from what they're doing in Yemen?
Well, yes, this is the problem with having a kitchen sink strategy. you have unintended consequence. I mean, in a way, it parallels U.S. policy in the Middle East over the last decade, certainly, if not more. We're always sitting back rehashing those unintended consequences, and usually it is destabilization of countries, the creation of chaos or a vacuum in power, which is then ably filled by, you know, the extremist group du jour, Al-Qaeda, and many similar groups. So in Yemen, we've already seen, by sort of having local domestic Yemeni players shift their attention away from the Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula threat, you've suddenly seen Al-Qaeda become more prominent and take over certain facilities and move into new areas. This is also what you've seen in Syria and Iraq, and seen little bits of in Lebanon. And a lot of it is blowback from the counter-revolutionary strategies that we've seen in the last 4 years. So wherever Saudi Arabia and its allies have meddled, we have seen quick destabilization, the creation of chaos and political vacuums or security vacuums, and then the entrance of non-state actors who are extremists and Islamists and jihadists. So, of course, we're going to see the similar blowback in Yemen. But in a way, you know, in different ways, too. I think the Saudi strikes against Yemen, which now total about 2,500 airstrikes, which is less than what U.S. airstrikes have been in Iraq since August 8th of last year, already have managed to galvanize a segment of the Yemeni population that would normally not support Saudi's adversaries, the Houthis, because, in fact, they're getting bombed, their homes are getting bombed, bridges and airports and stadiums and schools and warehouses are being bombed, and there are food shortages, electricity cutouts, and so forth. So, you know, the initial reaction is animosity and hostility from new segments of the Yemeni population that wouldn't otherwise be hostile to Saudi Arabia. And we are seeing this across the Middle East as well. I was looking just recently at a Pew poll that came out at the end of 2013, and they had measured pro and anti-Saudi sentiment in a variety of Arab Muslim states in 2007 and then again in 2013. And basically, in almost all the states, you'd seen significant drops in support for Saudi Arabia. In Turkey, 14% drop. In Palestinian territories, 13% drop. In Egypt, 13%. In Lebanon, a whopping 31%. So, yes, we are certainly seeing blowback. And it's amazing because Saudi continues to plod along the very same trajectory that has helped get it into its mess and expects, funnily enough, a different outcome.
Well, of course, that's often described as the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. And again, I'm speaking with Shamin Nawani, who's a political analyst, commentator on Middle East geopolitics, and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. She blogs at MiddleEastShuffle.com, and we're speaking to her in Beirut. Of course, one of the I don't know how to describe this in terms of black humor here, I guess. The idea that this wealthy Saudi prince, Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, is now offering free Bentleys to 100 Saudi pilots, 100 Bentley cars to 100 pilots who bombed Yemen. And this is happening at a time, of course, when a wealthy country like Saudi Arabia is bombing one of the poorest countries, and certainly the poorest country in the Arab world. But my understanding is, in spite of all that you've said about losing support around the neighborhood, apparently at home, this bombing campaign is very popular. Is there such a thing as Saudi patriotism? I'm not sure. It's such a strange, secretive place. We know there's an awful lot of poor people in spite of the monumentally wealthy family that controls the entire country. And as we've discussed, around the periphery, they have problems, and not the least of which is a Shia population in the oil-rich part on the Persian Gulf. So what's your sense then of that concept of Saudi patriotism? What's the glue there, apart from the religious police and the royal family? Is that sufficient, do you think?
Well, I think first we should, what you're calling Saudi patriotism, we should probably call Saudi propaganda. I mean, I'm sure inside Saudi Arabia for the last few weeks, there has been sort of, you know, the kinds of jingoistic headlines that we've seen, you know, in the United States during mission accomplished type wars. And
shock and awe, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, they probably don't have a very accurate picture of how Yemenis are feeling about this or others in the Middle East. So, you know, their government demonstrated that they have the ability to drop bombs from planes in spanking new American and UK delivered fighter aircraft and spanking new bombs and cluster munitions from Western allies. And, you know, it's war by television, and I'm sure they think they've done well. But, of course, that's not how the rest of the world is viewing this. I think there will be a corrective at some point. These things don't last long. If you remember how it was here, you know, there in the United States, when George W. Bush declared victory and mission accomplished, things soon spiraled downward, and, you know, journalists asked questions and the public asked questions. And, of course, now we are, the American public shows that it's not supportive of the Iraq war. But in inside Saudi Arabia, you know, they're facing, the Saudis are facing, or royal family are facing, a whole host of problems. You do have a new king, and his health is in question. And there are other princes chomping at the bit waiting for their turn, you know, into the seat of power or near the seat of power. But the Saudis, contrary to what we hear, is the Saudis, about a quarter of the Saudi population live at or below the poverty line. With a country of about 28 million, that means about 7 million are impoverished. And, you know, we're talking about many of these Saudis living on less than $17 a day. And one of their wealthiest princes is offering Bentleys to kill an average of 10 Yemenis to their fighter pilots. So more than two-thirds of Saudis are under 30 years old of age. Nearly three-quarters of all unemployed Saudis are in their 20s. And this came to a head fairly recently when now deceased King Abdullah, in the first year or so of the Arab Spring, worried that this would, you know, enter Saudi territory, offered up a $37 billion project to increase housing and raise salaries and produce unemployment benefits, et cetera. We, of course, don't know how that program has gone. There was some criticism early on that not enough was getting done. But, you know, these are all domestic problems, on top of which I think you mentioned that you have a robust minority Shiite population there who are disenfranchised and who live primarily in the oil-producing regions of Saudi Arabia in the eastern province. On top of that, you have Saudi Arabia now pretty much encircled by border states like Iraq and Yemen and Jordan, where conflict is going on, or there have been attacks on Saudi soil. So we have heard about bombings from Iraq across the Iraqi border into Saudi Arabia. What we didn't read in the English language press was bombings from Jordan around the same time into Saudi Arabia. And when I was in Jordan late last year, I was told that tens of thousands of Saudi troops had been moved to that border, which actually meant that they moved away from the Yemeni border, which they're traditionally at. On top of that, the Saudis have, you know, their paranoia is going from strength to strength. They are now in, I think, phase two of building a 1,400-kilometer fence along the Yemeni and Omani borders. Besides the threat around them from direct border states, we've seen Saudi Arabia in the last 2 years that has lost significant influence in Syria, in Lebanon, with Oman. Oman is the only GCC member that has not participated in this coalition bombing against Yemen. We've seen, you know, stalwart allies like Pakistan turn its back on assisting Saudi in this coalition. Countries like Pakistan and Turkey, furthermore, are engaged with Iran quite vigorously in trade, economic, and other opportunities. So Saudi Arabia is feeling under threat. But almost every one of these problems that has risen in the last few years has been as a direct result of Saudi Arabia's own actions. So, yeah, there are plenty of unintended consequences along the road for Saudi Arabia, and I expect many more to emerge in the near future.
We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Shamin Nawani. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And we're continuing the conversation with Shamin Nawani, who's a political analyst, commentator on Middle East geopolitics, and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College at Oxford University. She blogs at MiddleEastShuffle.com, and we're speaking to her in Beirut. So if there is any strategy that's discernible in what's happening in Yemen, it appears to be, first of all, it's pretty hard to degrade the Houthis because they're a bunch of guys with sandals and a Kalashnikov. They're not exactly rich targets. And then you've got, on top of that, apparently the targeting is mostly going against the former president, Saleh's military assets, you know, which are tanks and stuff that you can identify. And apparently they're trying to peel off his support, and there have been some defections from his ranks. He apparently stole something like $30 or $40 billion, so I guess he can afford to finance his private army. But do you think the Saudis could either make a deal with Saleh, since he seems to be, he's allied himself with the Houthis, he's clearly playing some kind of game there, or do you think the idea that they could bomb him into irrelevance?
Yeah, I think, you know, Ali Abdullah Saleh is kind of the unknown factor here, where he's going to turn up at the end of this game. But you're right, the Saudis are not going to be able to degrade the Houthis very successfully. These are rural highlanders who have now fought six wars in the last decade or so against Ali Abdullah Saleh, who was then ironically backed by the Saudis. And enriched by the Saudis. And the Saudis have always used their money to gain allies, whether it's Western allies or local domestic ones throughout the region. They have tried to split off support for the Houthis by enriching various Sunni tribes. But again, you know, carpet bombing a country is not going to win you many friends, and so, you know, it's unclear. I mean, perhaps the bombing was stopped because Sunni tribes were starting to question the rationality of that strategy. So in terms of whether, no, you can't defeat the Houthis. The Houthis, contrary to what we're reading, are not gaining weapons from Iran. Yemen is a weapons-rich country from the last six wars, and they have WikiLeaks itself has shown us that the U.S. government knows that the Houthis have been gaining most of their weaponry from domestic sources, whether it's the Yemeni black market or actually the Yemeni military. So I'm not sure how you can win against a group that is so determined to no longer be marginalized by the political system in Yemen, which is, in a sense, what the whole Arab Spring has been about, that is war-tested, both in conventional warfare and guerrilla warfare, the latter which the Saudis have little or no experience with. And, you know, to top that off, the Saudis have seen in the last few weeks that there are no countries willing to put boots on the ground. And, of course, we've not seen the Saudis willing to put boots on the ground in Yemen either. So this is not a winning situation for Saudi Arabia. What comes next? I'm not quite sure. They say they have the new phase of the war, which is renewal of hope. But from what I can see, it looks like they're going to besiege Yemen by water, air, and land, and hope to force behavior changes from within Yemen by applying the kind of pressure that can't be seen every day and caught on, cell phone footage and blasted around the world. So I think we're going to see Yemen going through even more of a humanitarian disaster conducted largely by the Saudis. And, you know, frankly, what are U.S. warships doing right there in Yemeni waters? They're going to help enforce the blockade of Yemen. I'm curious as to what Americans think of all this. Saudi Arabia received, I believe Congress approved in the first year of the Arab Spring, $69 billion worth of weapons to the primary counter-revolutionary state. Counter-revolution meaning pushing back against the will of the Arab people who were rising up against corrupt leaders. So, you know, 640 million of that, Ian, were cluster munitions, which is a banned munition. And we have seen the use of, by Saudi Arabia, of cluster munitions in their carpet bombing of Yemen. So I'm very curious to know where the U.S. stands in all of this, because surely the U.S. has some leverage against its closest Arab ally in the region.
Well, as you've pointed out in a recent article, Shamin Nawani, the U.S. needs to learn when to quit. And it would seem to me that we're entering a political season now, and you've already got some very hawkish Republicans led by John McCain who at every step are accusing Obama of weakness and recommending, and in John McCain's case, he recently spoke on the Senate floor urging Israel to go rogue and bomb Iran. So, you know, Obama said he was going to degrade, defeat, and destroy the so-called self-proclaimed Islamic State. But they're still alive and well. They're still taking territory in spite of all of the efforts of the Iraqi government and their Iranian allies and all of this U.S. bombing. So I expect as this election gets underway, there's going to be more calls for military intervention. Not that the record is so incredibly clear that in the last few years since the ill-fated invasion of Iraq, the lessons have been manifestly clear that military power and military might is simply not solving anything and is clearly making things worse.
Well, politicians like to talk a lot, and I think there is usually a marked difference between what a politician says on the campaign trail and what they do when they're in the White House. We've seen this with numerous presidents. I suspect that any incoming U.S. president, even a Republican, even a neocon, will be constrained by a new set of factors that weren't in place when George W. Bush was in office. First of all, I think global appetite for American military adventures has significantly reduced, certainly in the Middle East, certainly in the last few years. I think the balance of power globally has shifted as the economy has shifted. I think, you know, just like the Saudis, the U.S. has dealt with one series of unintended consequences after the other. And the destabilization of the Middle East for the objective, let's say, of undermining Iranian influence. And by the way, Iran hasn't had to do very much for its influence to increase. It's just had to sit back and watch the U.S. and the Saudis and the Israelis cause havoc in the region, lose popularity, and undermine their own alliances. You know, all this is has created a situation in which there's been so much destabilization that the United States has had to engage with Iran directly. Now, I wrote an article a year and a half ago that basically said there are not going to be any more boots on the ground in this region. The U.S. military has retreated. It is pursuing unconventional warfare strategies, which is to empower local populations to fight the fight for on behalf of the United States. And so the only way to fight the extremist threat that has risen as a result of these various political vacuums in the region is for actors within those destabilized countries to fight against ISIL and others like it. And then, lo and behold, ISIL went headfirst into Iraq. Everybody started taking it more seriously. The U.S. came to the table with Iran much more willing to engage because they understood, and as we're seeing today in the Syrian military theater, the Iraqi military theater, you have Iran, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq fighting off ISIS, and nobody else's troops, right? So they're the ones who face the existential threat. Let them fight the battle. Unfortunately, the U.S. has not yet struck an understanding with the Iranians. So the U.S. does what it does best, which is hedges its bets and tries to keep both situations going, reducing the ISIL threat somewhat, but not enough to let their adversaries gain. So we continue to see that kind of instability. I mean, why has the U.S. only conducted 1,760-odd airstrikes against ISIL targets in Iraq when the Saudis conducted 2,450 airstrikes in Yemen in a much, much shorter period? The goal is not to defeat ISIS. The goal is to gain leverage and to reduce ISIS's capabilities enough so that it doesn't continue to grow unchallenged and can be directed to activities that support U.S. goals in the region. So ultimately, the U.S. is not going to put boots on the ground in the region. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democratic president and what their policies are. The U.S. military is not going to participate in that and will push back. We've seen them push back on Syria, no matter what we've heard from a few generals. There were just as many on the other side saying this is a no-go. So, you know, if you don't put boots on the ground, there's only so much you can accomplish with airstrikes, and there's only so long you can conduct airstrikes before globally the international community rejects this kind of militarism. So, I'm not sure the U.S. can play economically, politically, or militarily in the various theaters, particularly the Middle East, in the way they did just 10 years ago. And I tell you, sitting here in the Middle East, that's a really good thing.
Well, just in the last minute or so, Charmaine, we've also just learned the limits of relying on drones, a drone strike that killed two of the American members of al-Qaeda, including their English language spokesperson, also killed an American hostage and an Italian hostage. So That's also pretty sobering because, as far as I can tell, in lieu of boots on the ground, there's an awful lot of reliance on drones.
Yeah, but in a way, they amount to the same thing as airstrikes. Somehow they go under the radar of the international community more than an outright, air invasion would be. And we've sort of been conditioned into accepting a certain amount of droning activity with plumped-up data that suggests to us that, in fact, most of the droning targets are legitimate military targets. What's in between, what's in the fine print is the fact that the U.S. military now considers males of military age, period, as legitimate targets, which could mean your kid, their kid. So the appetite for that is reducing as well. I mean, Pakistan is, in seeing Pakistani reaction when the government was considering joining the Saudi coalition was kind of fantastic. We had not seen the Pakistani public express that much disgust in a very, very long time. And I think we will see that same kind of backlash against continued U.S. droning activities or airstrike activities. So, populations are speaking out because there's nowhere else to go but the wall here. I mean, nothing's improved in years and years and years. There's only so much people will take, and there will always be that one event that triggers, popular dissent. And that's one thing local governments, however corrupt they are, cannot withstand. So when that happens, and there will be those consequences for U.S. actions, things will change rather dramatically and very quickly.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sharmeen Nawani.
Thanks, Ian. It was a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Sharmeen Nawani, who's a political analyst and commentator on Middle East geopolitics and a former senior associate at St. Anthony's College, Oxford University. She blogs at MideastShuffle.com, and we spoke to her in Beirut. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was